Good morning. I'm Katrina Kennison, your moderator for today. I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Gish Jen. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musician, Seven Times Salt, for the music we enjoyed while waiting for the live broadcast to begin. Also, thank you to the Putnam Foundation, New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, for generously sponsoring today's event. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year may be made on our website or through the mail. During this challenging time, we need your support more than ever. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will also be rebroadcast on WSMN next Sunday at 11 a.m. and on WUML this coming Wednesday at 10 a.m. As is the tradition at the Lyceum, after the presentation, Gish will answer questions from the audience. Please send your questions by using the comment section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email at monlyceum@gmail.com. After the broadcast, you may provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer's speakers, or join our mailing list through our website. Our speaker today is Gish Jen. In 1999, when the British publication, The Times Magazine, decided to do a millennial special on 20th century figures, preeminent in their fields and their chosen successors, they turned, not surprisingly, to John Updike. Who, they asked the great man, out of the generation of younger writers who's most admired, would he name as his literary successor? The writer whom Mr. Updike selected to succeed him back at the dawn of the 21st century is our speaker today, Gish Jen. At the time, Gish later recalled, she was as baffled by this honor as she was surprised. Why, after all, would this highly prolific, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning white male, who once identified his own literary landscape as the American small-town Protestant middle class, designate as his literary descendant the daughter of Chinese immigrants? An author, what's more, whose own fictional turf tends toward a provocative mashup of social, ethnic, and racial territory populated by a diverse spectrum of fully realized, convention-defying characters, be they Chinese, Jewish, Black, WASP, Irish, Japanese, Latino, or some combination thereof. Characters, it's worth noting, who are often as not enmeshed in families that are interracial, adoptive, interreligious, complicated, and challenged less by old-fashioned small-town mores than by the effects of globalization, development, fundamentalism, immigration, and in her most recent novel, The Resistors, by class warfare, an all-knowing internet that's half surveillance and half AI, and the price of non-compliance in a digitally empowered auto-America, an authoritarian state that feels disturbingly more and more like our own. And so, yes, on the surface, perhaps Gish was an unlikely choice. As it happened, although they did meet for a photo shoot for the story, Gish never got to ask Mr. Updike the question uppermost in her mind, which was, of course, why me? Here's a clue, though. Updike once described his personal critical touchstone for all his writing as a fervent relation with the world, which goes a long way, perhaps, toward explaining why he saw in Gish's work both kinship and, well, greatness. Certainly, he recognized in her an astonishing ability to dive deeply into life's complexities, possibilities, and wonders. The best writers reveal the world to us so that what is familiar becomes fresh and new, and what is unknown is suddenly and intimately revealed. To read a novel by Gish Jen is to be at once unsettled and charmed. It is to be moved to tears by one passage, to laughter in the next, and then, almost as if by magic, It is to be guided to a place of new understanding, questioning, self-examination, and awareness. Awareness of our differences and, too, of all that makes us human. The first time I met Gish in 1991, we were naked, with white towels wrapped around our pregnant bellies in the locker room of the Mount Auburn Health Club in Cambridge. And although it was the obvious fact of our impending motherhood that led us to start chatting that day, it took only minutes for us to discover quite an astonishing amount of overlap, given the randomness of our meeting. Well, the babies were born, and so was a lasting friendship. Today, those babies are grown men. The world we inhabit is one we could not have begun to imagine back in 1992. Or even, frankly, a year ago, when Gish first agreed to travel to Peterborough on a summer Sunday to discuss her soon-to-be-published novel, The Resistors. It seems fitting somehow that were it not for the wonders of technology, we would not be here at all this morning on what feels very much like a dystopian day. As a pandemic rages through the land, as Major League Baseball is being played to empty stadiums with piped-in crowd sounds, and as mothers in yellow t-shirts join arms to confront anonymous federal agents on our city streets, it seems especially fitting that we come together here in our virtual Lyceum to hear from a writer who has written a chilling cautionary tale about the future of our democracy, climate change, and powerful women. A novel that Newsday has hailed as a 1984 for our time. Gish, I am so very glad to welcome you this morning.
Katrina, it is truly my pleasure. Thank you so, so much for that extremely beautiful intro. Truly, I am moved to tears. Thank you. And it's wonderful. I can't wait till we get to talk.
I know. I mean, this is not exactly what we were envisioning for today, is it? Or we pictured that beautiful Unitarian church full of people, that airy room, a lovely reception afterwards, you know, handshake.
Exactly. Yes. I'm so forward to seeing your garden. But here we are instead. So good morning to all of you. Let me say before I start that I hope that you're all and surviving the pandemic okay. I myself have had a number of family members get sick. My mother did die of COVID in April, so I know how difficult it's been. One of the many things I've done to cope has been to buy this social media dress online. People who know me know that I would normally never wear something this color, but there it is. We're all coping as best we can. As we only have a short time together, I thought I'd say a few words and then talk to my old dear friend, Katrina, and then open it all up to questions for you. But first, let me say something about how I came to write this post-automation surveillance state feminist baseball dystopia about an apartheid-like state, which, to be honest, is a little amazing even to me. But the story starts in the fall of 2017. My younger child has just gone off to college. I've just helped her move into a dorm room. And like all empty nesters, I am despondent. I go home, I cry, I mope around. But then slowly it dawns on me that I now have control over my day for the first time in 28 years. Moreover, where I have just sat through freshman orientation and heard over and over again how important it is to have fun and explore and take risks, it occurs to me that maybe I should have fun and explore and take risks. And so I sit down to write whatever I damn well please. But of course, even though I have just given myself explicit permission to write whatever I want, lo and behold, I do not write a book about a girl's weekend in Paris involving devastatingly handsome men and designer drugs. Instead, I find myself writing a book about parents watching their daughter grow up and go off into the world. It is, unsurprisingly, a book full of the kind of worry that parents feel when they say goodbye to their freshman children. You know, drugs, the wrong guy, all the rest. The tension many of us know, too, between wanting to give our children their freedom and worrying that they will make wrong choices is very much there. But it isn't just a parent's worry that you see in The Resistors, of course. It is also the worry of a citizen. Because in the fall of 2017, as I was sitting down, it was 10 months into the Trump presidency, and it was already becoming clear we were on a somewhat worrisome trajectory. Of course, let me say that never in my wildest imaginings would I have envisioned what we're seeing in Portland today, with unmarked federal troops pulling protesters into vans, tear gassing lines of moms, much less, of course, dads blowing the tear gas back at the troops with leaf blowers. But the word Constitution does appear on page one of this book, and I am pretty concerned about the state of our democracy and the future of our freedom as I start to write. As I look forward into the future that my daughter will be entering, I'm also pretty concerned about the future of our planet and of race relations and of technology. A lot of this is in reaction to things that have just happened as I was sitting down. In 2017, we had just had a number of really horrific hurricanes and fires. There was hugely growing concern about the environment and about climate change. In 2017, too, we had just had a pretty concerning back and forth between Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. I don't know if you'll remember this, but Facebook had been conducting an AI experiment in which bots had begun to speak to each other in a non-human language, alarming Elon Musk and many others. Did I imagine that just 3 years later, we would see announcements like the one some of you may just have seen about AI networks using photons instead of electricity with a potential 100 to 1,000 fold increase in speed and power? No. But looking at my Roomba and Siri and Alexa, and of course my children with their eyes glued to their phones, I did wonder where technology might bring us, what wonders it would bring, but also who it would empower and whether enormous social change would ensue. On the more hopeful side, 2017 was also the year that Colin Kaepernick took a knee, giving rise, I'm sure, to the idea that a sporting event could be a site of political resistance, as it is in the resistors. And it was, of course, the year that opened with the Women's March. And I'm sure the pink hats of that march did contribute to the fact that one form of resistance in my book takes the form of knitting. I'm going to read two sections from my book today, one a bit longer to give you a general sense of it, and then a very short one to give you a sense of how baseball figures in it all. I should say here that a lot of people have asked me about the baseball, and there are artistic reasons for it, of course. Baseball is the great American game. It does have what Walt Whitman calls the snap-go fling of the American atmosphere. And as we can see by the importance to this day of things like Dr. Fauci throwing out the first pitch of the baseball season, and of the Yankees and the Washington Nationals all taking a knee at that same first game, something that was organized, by the way, not by the management, but by the players themselves, baseball continues to have enormous emotional resonance for us, embodying, as it does, so many democratic ideals, from the level playing field to the idea that everyone should have a chance at bat. But beyond the artistic reasons for my use of baseball, there are personal reasons for it as well, starting with the fact that neither one of my children has ever had any interest in baseball whatsoever. My daughter is in the next room as I speak to you, and I think that she would attest, were she to come out, that were I to write anything that seemed to have anything whatsoever to do with her actual life, my head would roll. But as it happens, neither she nor my son has, to the best of my knowledge, ever managed to make a bat actually come in contact with the ball, much less thrown one or caught one with any distinction whatsoever. And so baseball was safe writing territory for me. But also baseball was very much part of my family culture growing up. I do come from a Chinese immigrant family for whom baseball was a portal to American life, as it is for many immigrants, meaning that my parents first performed being American, if you will, by going to baseball games and rooting for the Yankees and eating hot dogs. I don't think it's any coincidence that my brother went on to become a star pitcher in the city of Yonkers, New York, where I grew up. He was one of the very best young pitchers in the city, so much so that he was introduced to and taught to throw a curveball by Tom Seaver. Indeed, so important did baseball become to my family that when we buried my mother in April, we did bury her with a Yankees cap. In any case, here's the beginning of the book. As many of you know, the father of the family and the narrator is named Grant. He is married to Eleanor, a lawyer. They have this marvel of a daughter, Gwen, and they live in a country called Auto America, which is presided over by a kind of AI augmented internet they call Aunt Nettie. And this country is divided into two classes, the netted, who are allied with Aunt Nettie, and the surplus. So this is from the beginning of the book. As her parents, Eleanor and I should have known earlier. But Gwen was a preemie to begin with. That meant oxygen at first, and after that, special checkups. And her early months were bumpy. She had jaundice, she had roseola, she had colic, she had a heart murmur. Things that I can now see distracted us, especially with the one chance policy. We were focused on her health to the exclusion of all else. For the netted, it was different, of course. But for us surplus, the limit was one pregnancy per couple. And Eleanor was just out of jail. Outside the house, she had a drone minder tracking her every move. The message was clear. She was not getting away with anything. And in any case, we loved Gwen and would never have wanted to replace her. Worried that we were that she was delicate, that she might never consume the way she needed to, the way we all needed to. Not that charges of underconsumption couldn't be fought in the courts. This was Auto America, after all. For all the changes wrought by AI and automation, now rolled up with the internet into the eye burrito we called Aunt Nettie, we did still have a constitution. And if anyone could defend what was left of our rights, it was our own fierce Eleanor, of whom even the platoons of Canada geese who patrolled our neighborhood, the pit bulls, one might say, of the waddling world, were afraid. But as Eleanor's incarceration brought home, these battles had a price. And in the meanwhile, even worrying and weighing the options distracted us from realizing other things. Things we might have noticed a bit earlier had Gwen had a sibling. It is so hard for a new parent to imagine a child any different from the one he or she has. Children do so have their own gravity. They are their own normal. And so it is only now that we can see that there were signs. All children take what's in their crib and throw it, for example. It's universal. But Gwen threw her stuffed animals straight through her bedroom window. Her bedroom doorway. They shot out, never so much as grazing the doorframe, and they always hit the wall of the staircase across from her bedroom at a certain spot, with the precise force they needed to bounce forward and drop clean down to the bottom of the stairwell. Was she maybe two when she did this? Not even, although she was already a southpaw. And already she seemed to have unusually long arms and long fingers, or so I remember remarking one day. Not that Eleanor and I had so many babies on which to base our comparison. Ours was just an impression, but it was a strong impression. Her fingers were long. I remember, too, having to round up a veritable menagerie on the landing before I could start up the stairs. The stuffed hippo, the stuffed tiger, the three or four stuffed dogs, the stuffed orca and toucan and platypus and turtle. I gathered them all into my arms like the storybook zookeeper of some peaceable kingdom. It was as if I, too, ought by rights to have been made of plush. And, of course, our house was automated, as all surplus houses were required to be by law, and the animals could easily have been clear-floated. All I had to do was say the word, and the house spots would emerge from their closets, their green appendages poised to help. That's my cat, if you're wondering what that noise is. Clear-float now? Aren't those animals in your way? And we can roll and clear if you'd prefer. You have a choice. You always have a choice, the choice business being a new feature of the program. A bit of cyber ingratiation, you might say, to balance its more habitual cyber intimidation. If you trip, it will be your own fault, for example, and do note that your choice is on the record. Nothing is being hidden from you. Your choice is on the record. Meaning that I was losing living points every time. Living points being something like what we used to call brownie points when I was growing up. Except that these were more critical than money for everything from getting a loan to getting a plane ticket to getting Gwen into NetU one day, should we dream of doing that. A goal that people said involved tens of thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of points. But I picked the animals up myself anyway, as did Eleanor when it was she who came upon them. And all because we wanted to dump the animals into Gwen's crib ourselves and hear her quick, cresting laughter as she immediately set about hurling them again. Everything was a game to her, a most wonderful, loving, endless game,
Her spy eyes lit up with mischief. Her tea brown cheeks flushed the hot orange pink you see on the underside of clouds at sunset. Often she laughed so hard she fell as she threw, plopping down on her soft bottom, but grabbing the crib rail so hard as she scrambled back up that the whole crib shook. Was this the delicate newborn we had once so anxiously tended? Now breathtakingly robust, indestructible it seemed, she wore an old-time soft yellow blanket sleeper with attached feet and bunny ears, a hand-knit, extra-warm version of a suit Eleanor remembered from her own childhood. None of this baby's own heating over Gwen's crib, in other words. She hardly seemed to need zone heat in any case, having learned so early to blow on her hands if they were cold and to cuddle less if she needed to for warmth. Indeed, we were all given to cuddling, and we all wore sweaters, too, to avoid turning on the zone heat, for which we were constantly house-scolded. Don't you find it a bit chilly? Why not choose to turn on the zone heat? You'll be more comfortable. Don't you find it a bit chilly? But we ignored it. For this was how the auto house started, wasn't it? With thermostats that sent to Aunt Nettie first data, then videos. Then came drone deliverers and fridge stockers, kid trackers and robo-sitters, elder helpers and yard bots, all of which reported to Aunt Nettie as dutifully as any spy network, recording our steps, our pictures, our relationships, sent back when we seemed to be surplus, still have them, our careers. And she, in turn, took what she knew and applied it, even proffering along the way solace and advice. Indeed, in the early days of automation, I myself brought up Ask Aunt Nettie more often than I care to recall, and can still remember her consoling voice as she volunteered, "I'm here," and insisted, "I want to hear everything," and reassured me, "Of course you feel that way, Grant. How could you not? You're only human." I did laugh at that, "You're only human." Like others, I had allowed Aunt Nettie to keep my calendar back in the days when, as the young head of an English as a second language program, I still had immigrants to teach and obligations to juggle. This was some time ago now, back before Ship 'Em Back. But like others then, I had also allowed Aunt Nettie to email people on my behalf, checking the Mimic Your Voice option and marveling at just how perfectly she could replicate my tics of phrasing, especially since, because in my youthful diligence, I had sent so many thousands of emails. Indeed, Aunt Nettie had so much data on me that not even Eleanor could tell it was not I who had composed the messages she received from my account. And like others, too, I had taken advantage of the easy tools offered to me and trained Aunt Nettie to write my lessons in my syllabi, even to generate sample sentences and punny jokes. Indeed, I trained her so well that I had more than once observed that an avatar could now run the class. As for why I did these things, I generally did this. I appreciate some, so it could be just to say that because I could be, as my mother liked to say, lazy as hell. And as for the melting reality, concerningly, like the sea level rise and heat and wind we knew long ago would come with climate change, the stranding of whole office parks and schools and neighborhoods, but the flooding we saw now. No one would have willfully chosen the generating of the places we called maroon places, just as no one would have chosen the extinction of frogs and of polar bears or the decimation of our pine and spruce forests by the explosion in the number of bark beetles. And yet, it was something we humans did finally choose. After all, it was not the earth that chose it, or any other creature. It was we who made our world what it was. It was we who were responsible. And now I'm just going to read another very short section about the baseball. Then we'll start talking to Katrina. At this point in the story, Gwen has become a star pitcher, and she and her teammates are getting ready to play in the Olympics against the China-Russia team. The Time Russia team has been genetically improved. And so among many other things, they are terrifying because all of the Time Russia players are switch hitters. So Gwen and her teammates are terrified. Perhaps all this was fear, pure and simple, on the part of Gwen's teammates. But feeding their obsession, of course, was the sense that baseball was more than a sport, that it was a crown jewel. There were people who said it wasn't even invented in America. There were people who pointed out that it was mentioned by Jane Austen long before it was ever mentioned here. But if baseball took on a hallowed meaning, it took on that meaning in our American dreams. For was this not the level playing field we envisioned, the field on which people could show what they were made of? And didn't we Americans believe above all that everyone should have a real chance at bat? Didn't we believe that with the good of the team at heart, something in us might just hit a ball off our shoe tops and send it sailing clear out of the park? If Gwen teammates were playing Time Russia for something, I thought, it was for this. For a chance to show, my mother would have said, that even if we all returned to the dirt and the wind and the rain, like the plants and the animals, we had a bigness in us, something beyond algorithms and beyond upgrades, something we were proud to call human, or so it seemed to me. And I'll stop there.
Oh, Gish, I feel like I could just listen to you read that entire novel. Did you record the audio by chance?
I did not. I did not.
Too bad. I was just going to say, keep reading. It's been a while since I've read your book, but listening to you read, so many things came to mind. And one, I just want to share with you and with our audience, I don't think I quite appreciated the importance of baseball until we found ourselves in the midst of this pandemic, and the season, of course, was canceled. And our son, Henry, who's a college professor, has been home with us since March, teaching remotely. And then when it was time for baseball to start and there was no baseball, as true fans know, ESPN started broadcasting old games. And at our house, those old games went on just while we were making dinner every night. And it was something about everybody needed the background noise of baseball to make life feel a little bit more normal, no matter that these were games that had been played 10 years ago. It was just the sound of the game, of the announcers, giving us some sense of normalcy in what is clearly not a normal time. Which kind of brings me to my first question to you, which is, one thing that strikes me in the novel is how completely accommodating your characters have become to this world, a world in which their main job is to be avid, constant consumers. And all of their everyday movements inside the house, outside of the house, are being monitored. And much of the world the land is underwater. A large segment of the population is involuntarily unemployed. So I can't help thinking about how right now we too are normalizing a government that seems beyond the pale. We're normalizing the destruction of norms that we believe to be inviolable in a way most of us could not have begun to imagine on the eve of the 2016 election. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about both the dangers and also the necessities of normalizing what is not normal in order to keep living.
Well, of course you have, you know, we will do that, right? And we, as you're saying, we see that right now. But it's also true that, you know, I think that, you know, we accept it, but we don't accept it, right? I mean, of course, we've done this our whole lives. We accept that we have to go to school when we'd rather not go to school, right? We accept that we do our taxes, we'd rather not do our taxes. Of course, so we do accommodate many, many things. But we do have this little voice in us that resists, right? There is a little voice that says, actually, I don't really want to do my taxes. And actually, I would actually rather go play baseball than go to school. And we have that little voice. And I guess one of the things, you know, as a writer, writer, when I think of what my job is, I think my job is to keep us in touch with that little voice. I mean, we can't act on every single impulse that we have that runs counter to what society is asking us to do. But we can remember that actually we do have this voice, and sometimes that voice is not a help voice. We do all have to do our taxes, but sometimes it's the key to retaining our humanity. You know, I think Thomas Haney says that, you know, art steadies us. And, you know, I think that it steadies us, but, you know, like you, by helping us remember ourselves, like remembering what we really think. So that, you know, this thing that's going on in Portland, so it's not normal. So the voice that says to you, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to stand in that line, and I'll stand in that line of moms, and I am going to resist, is nothing could be more important, both for our country and for ourselves and for our own sanity.
Yeah.
I guess I think that art has a place in all this.
Especially at a time when so many of the arts that bring us together are dark and silent. Like there are no communal experiences of art right now. This is about as close as we get, yeah. Sitting in our rooms in separate places, connecting virtually. But that sense of, like, as we expected today, we would be all gathered in a room together, carrying on that Lyceum tradition. And instead, here we are. So in a way, it seems to me the printed word too becomes more important than ever. We find our community on the page because we're not finding it in those Broadway theaters or concert halls or I noticed the characters in the Resistors they're passionate gardeners and they're bakers and they're knitters, and I read the book, of course, long before the pandemic, and there was part of me at that time was like, really? They're going to do all this knitting? That all seemed a little bit over the top. Well, but you know, the seed companies this spring ran out of seeds, and the slow stitching movement has completely exploded on Instagram, and there are thousands of recipes for banana bread floating around on the internet. I just ordered a sewing machine and I have taken up embroidery. So I have something to do with my hands besides wring them every night. But I wonder what it is about these kind of simple, old-fashioned pastimes that exert such a pull in times of profound stress. When everything else is unraveling, oddly enough, we turn to knitting. And I wonder if you could talk too about precisely why in your book, knitting?
Well, of course, I myself, you know, when I had time, did a lot of knitting, I will say. I was an avid knitter all through my youth and through college. I don't knit so much now. I expect if I ever have grandchildren that I will be knitting again. I think that's, you know, some of these things, you know, they are so fundamental to you know, because these are age old traditions, right? So this is not Netflix, which was, you know, invented yesterday, you know, these are things that evolved over centuries and centuries and centuries for good reasons. And I think that in the case of knitting, you do have a repetitive, beautiful activity that results in things that literally keep our loved ones warm. I think, I guess it's sort of say, I think a lot of these activities are very tied to our actual needs, right? Which we need to keep warm. We need to feed ourselves. So of course, cooking is important. Of course, it is important to every culture in the history of mankind. And of course, we return to that now. So because we're just stripping down to, you know, what do we really need? And it turns out a lot of what we thought we needed, like going to the mall, it seems like we actually don't need that. But could we live without that? Yes, we could live without that. Can we live without clothing ourselves, clothing people we love, keeping them warm? Can we live without feeding ourselves and our loved ones? No, we can't, right? So I guess it's simple to say that it's not, you know, I wish we weren't at this place in our history. But it's not a surprise to me that we return to these things. And I will say that reading is one of those very basic activities. It was a technology that was invented a gazillion years ago,
doesn't require a lot of technology to engage in. And so I'm not surprised that reading should have also enjoyed this kind of resurgence.
Exactly. So I'm in Maine this week with my parents and my son, and we start out with the news of the day and we kind of take in what we need to know. And then we all very quickly almost scurry to our books. It's like we want to live in that world of the page. And it's like the reading is informing our response to what's actually going on. So absolutely. So you mentioned as you were talking about your process for writing the book that at the heart of this book is a young woman heading off to college and her parents confronting the reality of that empty nest, you know, a place all of us parents have been. And concurrently right now, there are parents across this country facing maybe the possibility of, rather than an empty nest, college age children staying home this year or young children not going back to school. And so these concerns that we have as parents, empty nest, not empty nest. My son Henry just was told that he can teach his college classes remotely this semester, so he'll be home. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those feelings you had sending your daughter off that brought you to your keyboard, brought you to this theme of the empty nest, and maybe juxtapose that with nests that are not emptying as we had expected that they would.
Well, I have to say that it's been a very happy experience that, in 2017, I sent my daughter off. I was full of trepidation. There is a way in which this book, you know, it does raise every single thing that could go the matter with the world. And it's almost a little memo to my daughter to sort of say, you know, and when you're thinking about, you know, what your education is preparing you for, here is a list of problems that you might undertake. And so if you want to address any of these things with your education, that would be a good thing. And you might bear that in mind as you study. Now I'm the very happy, like I say, in 2017, I'm all worry and who knows, right? Who knows? And you know, you are aware that you're giving your child a freedom that they haven't had before. And you know, what are they going to do themselves? What, you know, are they going to choose to do something about the world, or are they going to choose not to? You know, I mean, really basic things are, you know, the values that you brought them up with, you know, will they themselves uphold those values, or will you find that they rebel in ways that you really wish they wouldn't, but that you have to let them, of course. But now, because of COVID, I will say that I do have my college-age daughter back living with us, and we've had the very, very, it's like I get to see the postscript to the resistors, you know, and maybe in the resistors, you know, Gwen does take up her mother's work, and of course, that's a little wish fulfillment in there. But my daughter's extremely different than me. But I will say that we get to see what happened after Sarah said, go forth, take risks, explore, do whatever you want. What she's actually decided to do with herself I couldn't have wished for more. So I will say that here in COVID, because we get to see her day to day, we can see the person that she's become. And in, you know, very, you know, up close and personal. And it's, for us, it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I will say too, that in a general kind of way, like many people, you know, of course in my family, we've always really valued family. But I think that COVID has given us a special appreciation of, you know, the people we love, what they mean to us. Like I say, the same way we strip down to, you know, keeping people warm, you know, the basics, keeping people fed. And now during this time, it's very clear who really, really matters and what really, really matters. And of course, in this household, certainly number one would be the children still.
I think that is one of those things that brought us together all those years ago, right? And has been kind of a running thread through our friendship, indeed. Yeah. And really, we've had such a similar experience. We have one grown son who is living in Asheville, has kept his job, his house, is considered an essential worker. And so, of course, we worry about him because in his way, he's out there on the front lines. And but to see our older son return home, and he's been teaching online this summer. And of course, I know him only as my son, as he is in the household. But to eavesdrop on him as a college professor and as a teacher, which I've been doing all summer, and to hear the professor lures, or that's been quite a revelation. And to see, oh, this is the guy that is out there in the world. Like, that's a person that I had not had an opportunity to see. I have certainly never sat in on one of his classes, and to get to be a fly on the wall for that has been a huge gift. As you mentioned, this kind of stripping away, suddenly, I'm sure you're going through this too, as a writer very much in demand, you have all sorts of requests. You could be busy all day long, fulfilling obligations to other people. And when you realize there's just so much time, and where do you want your energy to go? And at this moment, it's very much that inner circle of family. I mean, we're kind of here studying each other, doing what we can to help in the wider world, but family first for now, for sure. So The Resistors, back to your novel, and I was so reminded of this as you read, chilling as it is, there is a kind of a buoyancy, which I think of as kind of the Gish Gen buoyancy, a lightheartedness, even to this dark tale. So I wonder, was it fun for you to write?
Yes. Well, you can hear that, you know, I have control over my day for the first time in 28 years, you know, and so there is a tremendous, you know, like, oh my God, I can do whatever I want. You know what I mean? I can get up when I want. I don't have to make breakfast or lunch or dinner for anybody. I don't have to go to, you know, school meetings of any kind. I don't have to drive carpool. So yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely out and about and having a great time. And of course I'm having a great time too, just in having allowed myself to write in this, to do this kind of thing that I never would have imagined, you know? So there's a way in which I have very little ego at stake. I mean, I've never written a dystopia before. I have no expectations of myself. And certainly if I tell anybody about it, they have no expectations of me either. And that's, that also is just wonderfully liberating. And of course my book is also full of, you know, optimism. And that's because even though I say how worried I was about my child, you know, I have seen in this younger generation, just, you know, tremendous energy. They're so well educated, you know, they're so informed, they're so engaged. So, you know, you do sort of see kind of on one hand, I'm thinking, oof, you know, the world is really not, you know, headed in a good direction. On the other hand, I'm looking at the young people, I'm thinking, wow. And so I think that those, you know, those two impulses, I think, are very much there. You know, I'm thinking like, holy Toledo. I mean, I don't know how many other people feel that the kids are just much better educated than we were at their age. But from my small sample, I have to say that, you know, it's mind-boggling how smart they are and how savvy they are, and how committed they are. So anyway, so they gave. But you were right. I also just was having a lot of fun.
Well, I do picture you there, kind of inventing this world and this accumulating of, I could do this, I could do that, and take this one step further, and this is what it would look like, and maybe it would be great for you to just talk a little bit about that process of world creating, which you clearly enjoyed, even though it's also kind of like, oh my goodness, like we're only a step or two away from this world I'm creating. But talk a little bit about world creating, if you would.
You know, the funny thing is that, you know, people ask me about that because I gather now in the MFA programs, they're a world, you know, there were world building classes, and I actually never took any such class. They did not have those classes when I was in graduate school, and I had never actually heard this term, you know, kind of world building, until I'd actually already written my book. But I will say that it was astonishingly easy for me. I mean, I myself was very surprised at how easy it was. And it was only after my book was done that I looked back and I remembered that I actually read a lot of science fiction when I was in junior high school. So I was a big fan of Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and, you know, Arthur C. Clarke. And, you know, and so and clearly all that stuff had stayed with me. And, you know, I mean, I, like I say, you know, it was very much buried. I mean, I hadn't read any of that stuff in, 20, 30 years. So I was not conscious of it. But when I started to make the world up, then it just came like nothing. I mean, it was just like I was not working at it at all. I was just having fun and this one thing would pop up after the next. And I realized like, oh, you know, it, you know, that early reading experience was still with me. And I think many of us had that experience that something that you've read, like really, you know, you could have read it really quite a long time ago and that it actually does lodge in there. And then all of a sudden, you know, you turn a corner and there it is, you know, your earlier self and these books. So I don't know if that's any kind of answer. The MFA students, of course, all want to know how I did it. And the answer is, I don't know.
I do picture you with a little notebook at hand and things popping into your head and, oh, I could do this, I could do that. Or
I almost made it up as I was going. Yeah. I mean, it was just kind of on the fly, you know, ship them back, you know. I don't know why.
Well, there was a line that you read to us this morning. I think I got it right. It's Grant saying, it was we who made our world what it was. Mm-hmm. It was we who were responsible. And I remember underlining that line when I read the book, and it haunts me to this day. Because we can look around at so many of the choices that we're making, and we are creating the world in your novel. And I realized this the other night, our family were way up in this house in Maine, where until 3 weeks ago, we had gone 40 years with my parents owning this house with no internet, no cell phone service here whatsoever. And finally, it was like, if people are going to be coming and going here and trying to get anything done, we're going to have to bite the bullet, get internet, get cell service. So we finally did that. And the other night, we were eating dinner and we began to talk about beautiful handmade carved salad bowls. And I told my parents about the last time I was out and about before the pandemic. I had stopped in the Andrew Pierce store in Woodstock, Vermont, and looked at beautiful handmade salad bowls. So we had a little conversation at dinner about that. The next day, my mother and I both on our phones were bombarded with advertisements for hand-carved wooden salad bowls. We were not on our phones. The TV was off. Aunt Nettie was present at our dinner table. And that line, it was we who made our world what it was. It was we who are responsible. So where do we go from here? Can we roll it back?
It's resist. You know, I mean, I think that what we can do is resist, right? So, you know, we do need to press for legislation to kind of regulate some of these things. The good news is that the resistance is there. I mean, I right now I'm speaking to you from Northern Vermont, the home of the homemade salad bowl. There are so many woodworkers and bakers and brewers up here, and people are very much in touch with the things that they really care about. They come up here to be in touch with that. And I'm sure that's true in many parts of New Hampshire as well. But that of course is important, but it is also important, you know, to keep an eye on our legislators and make sure that they don't willy-nilly give our country away to corporate interests, right? That they don't take our interest in beautiful things and exploit that. It should be something just like your interest in your child, which is, it just is for its own sake. Nobody should take these things that we love and then immediately an opportunity for profit in them. And if they are able to do that, it's up to us to stop them and to sort of say, actually, you know, this is our world. And, I'm not totally anti-capitalism, I will say. I spent enough time in third world countries to understand that capitalism actually is an incredibly successful human invention that has lifted many, many people out of really, really dire and backbreaking poverty.
So I'm not against it, but I do think that it's up since we invented this great thing. You know, it's important for us that we ride it rather than allow it to ride us. You know, it is our invention, and we can also invent the regulation, that is necessary to keep it something that serves us rather than something that we must serve.
Maybe you could make a bit of a distinction between capitalism and consumerism, which is such a theme in the novel. And certainly during this pandemic, I think, as we were talking about earlier, people are really examining buying habits. Like, I think the clothing industry, nobody's going anywhere. We all have plenty of clothes in our closets. It went down something like 87% this spring. There is a lot of pressure coming from the top to get out there and buy things. And of course, we have what we need. But maybe you could talk a little bit about the consumerism in your novel. It's expected. I mean, people are very high.
Right. You know, the consumerism keeps the engine running, you know? And it is exploiting something in people. People do love new things, and they can be very beguiled by that. But also, as more and more of our lives get taken up doing activities that we don't really want to engage in. I mean, I'm very lucky because most of my day is spent writing, which is something I do want to be doing. But many, many people spend their lives doing something they don't really want to be doing, and then because they don't feel good, you know. What do they do? They will go and buy something. It's an easy way to kind of make yourself feel better. But of course, what should really be happening is if we are a country that is able to feed people and clothe people very efficiently, thanks to capitalism, you know, maybe we should be cutting back on hours. They talk about this in the book, you know, like, well, why don't we have fewer working hours, you know, so that we can get to what we want. So we can, like I say, so we can get to a point where we're not in trouble in terms of being able to house ourselves or feed ourselves or clothe ourselves. Maybe we could just kind of stop there, though. And then, you know, at that point, the machine kind of takes over. And now all of a sudden we find ourselves working 100 hours a week. And then, like I say, at the end of that 100 hours, like, all we can really do is go buy ourselves a new dress because we really feel so terrible. Well, you know, maybe this is like this is something that we can stop ourselves. I think COVID is actually giving us a great opportunity to hit reset. And like, I think just as you're saying, Katrina, I think many people are feeling that it's a time to reexamine. And maybe, you know, it's not going to be same old, you know. I think that that would be a very, I mean, this is a terrible way to have to learn our lesson. But, you know, it is possible to take this moment to resist some of these forces that we don't really want to govern our lives, and to really take an active role in shaping the world so that it can actually reflect what we want and what we need. And capitalism being part of that, but not all of it.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is, like, we all need to find our way to become resistors.
Yes.
Ourselves.
Absolutely.
And could you talk a little bit about how you, members of your family, what you're doing these days to become part of the solution? Or advice that you might have for readers and listeners is, like, it's so easy to feel helpless right now. And it's so easy to feel like, you know, the forces that are coming to bear on us are bigger than all of us. And it's easy to feel despair.
Well, it is. But of course, you know, one of the things I do is, as you know, I talk to a lot of people. You know, I do talk to a lot of people. You know, we definitely have, you know, we compost and we cook and all those things. And, you know, we definitely have a lot of, you know, my husband, we're in the past, you know, our house needed repainting. In the past, we certainly would have probably had somebody do that. But now, you know, my husband paints our own house, you know. So there's a lot of do-it-yourself here. Are fixing more things, you know. We don't just throw them out. I mean, we don't even know where we go to replace them. So, you know, we fix them. We actually, one of the things we did is we adopted a feral cat.
you know, our cat. She could eat out from our shelter. She was very, very wild. I mean, you know, maybe many would have thought that she could not be socialized at this point. But we did. We did socialize her, and now she's a happy purring thing. But so that's been a very happy healing thing. Were it not for COVID, there's just no way that we would have the time and energy, you know, to take a little cat like that and to just really, you know, just stay at her. You know, when she came, all she did was hiss, just hissed at us, hid under the counter, you know, would not come out to eat while we were there, would not let anybody touch her, would not, you know, much less, she would not even eat if we were in the room, you know, she would not eat. And yeah, like I say, just hissing, clawing, you know, everything. Now, you know, she's a little purring, happy kitty. And like I say, you know, I think that maybe that was a good thing that we did, and that it gave us, instead of focusing on ourselves, you know, I mean, the days just, you know, revolved around her name is Natasha. You know, the days revolved around Natasha and what Natasha needed rather than what we needed, you know.
What it makes me think about is that beautiful line of advice from Clarissa Pinkola Estes, when she talks about mend the part of the world within your reach, you know, really, and if we all mended that part of the world within our reach, those parts would start to overlap and we would be healing, you know.
I think, you know, that is so wise and so true. And, you know, and so mostly here we focus on the cat, on making sure my daughter can go on and do what she's meant to do. She's actually still really busy because she's in college, and she's a debater, so she has a debate team to run, and she's pretty busy. And so, you know, so much of it is just focused on those things. Yeah. And I will say, though, but it is a time when, you know, we ourselves, you know, it's like we let our lawn go wild, and so we had all these wildflowers come up. And every day we actually get to look at the wildflowers in a way that, with this not happening, we just...
Home has really become a place that we fully and deeply inhabit rather than that place that we touch down for refueling and repacking the suitcase and then off to the next thing. It's like, we feel that too. We're just really deeply here.
Yeah, we're deeply here. Yeah. In a funny kind of way, of course, we want the pandemic to go away.
Yeah.
But we're not sure about, letting go of this whole way that we're...
Well, living. I think in just the moment that we have left, I want to ask you the question that we've asked around our dinner table all summer. And that is, what have you learned about yourself during this time?
Well, you know, it's funny, but... You know, it's an interesting question, but you know, one thing that this is not maybe the answer to your question exactly, but one thing that I've become aware of is just, God, how little time there is left, and how I mean, that sounds funny. I'm not that old. I'm not any older than you are, but it seems like there's so little time left. Yeah. So, want to do
a sense of time's preciousness.
It's so precious, and I almost can't, if I think about it, I will almost freeze, you know. And and I think I've learned to let go of a lot of things, you know. Like, it's funny, but it's just amazing how much I really don't care about at all. You know, I really
feel like we care even more passionately
than
ever before about other things. Like at my house, the bird baths get cleaned and filled twice a day because I want those birds to have water, clean, fresh water, you know? And really, I used to fill the bird baths when I thought of it, which wasn't every day. So I think that's what you're kind of getting at, right? A little bit.
Katrina, you are so much more articulate than I.
No, I'm just watching the birds a lot.
It's about feeding the bird baths every day. Every day. Yeah.
Oh, well, Kish, I am realizing that our time is drawing to a close here. And I just want to say thank you so much. I wish that we were heading off to lunch together, which was the original plan. But that will come on a future day. And just having this connection and sharing you with readers and listeners, not only in Peterborough, but thanks to this technology all over the world, is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So thank you
indeed, America,
so much for your time this morning.
My pleasure, Katrina. Lots of love to everyone.
And Gish's books, of course, are for sale locally at the Toadstool Bookshop or online through the Toadstool. They will be happy to mail you copies of The Resistors or any of Gish's other volumes. And with that, I will just let everyone know that our program next Sunday will feature Rebecca Haynes, who will talk about why children's popular culture matters, the politics of children's toys and media. We hope you have enjoyed today's live broadcast of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you so much for your support of our unique 2020 season. We hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you.